Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. This is Mystery Train, RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special. That's the Books there in a song called Venice. And you'll know why I played that in just a moment. Every night on a Sunday, we get someone in to pick the music. And tonight, I'm delighted that it is the artist, Jessie Jones. How are you doing, Jessie?
Hi, John. How are you?
Lovely to see you. I've always wanted to see what you would do if I got you in on a Sunday night to pick tunes.
Well, I hope I haven't disappointed now.
No, you won't. And I play that Venice track because of the Venice Biennale and all of that kind of stuff. And we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about your work and your practice and all the rest of it as the night goes on. But one thing for sure, I knew where you would start. And I knew your first choice would be Elvis Presley.
Yeah, it has to be.
Because it's no accident that you're called Jessie Jones. So tell me about how you got your name Jessie.
I think when I talked to you about this before, it was kind of, I do always forget that my middle name is Presley, and then I go to the airport and everyone's like, oh. But yeah, my name is Jessie Presley Jones, and when Elvis died, my mum was pregnant and my dad wanted to call me Elvis. And my mum was like, what if it's a girl? We can't call a girl growing up in St. Michael's Estate in Chicor Elvis. And my mum had the great idea to call me Jessie. So it was, Elvis had a twin brother who died, I think, seconds after Elvis was born. So, yeah, it's been actually one of my dreams to go to Gracelands. I still haven't done it yet, to visit Jesse Garin's grave and obviously his brother Elvis's grave as well, you know, hopefully someday.
You should go because
I'd love to.
It's a much better experience than you would imagine it is.
Yeah, I think because I know it's going to be moving, I'm like saving it, you know.
Well, you should go because it's worth seeing and it's a good experience, actually.
Yeah.
Some kind of scary Presley fans around the place, but you're not quite one of those.
Well, Elvis fans are so obsessive, aren't they?
Well, they're different types, aren't there? You know, there are Elvis fans who love the music.
Yeah.
And quite rightly, because, I mean, he was a bit of a thunderbolt when it came to music.
Yeah.
But then there are others who are in love with some other kind of thing that they think he represents.
Yeah. I was the youngest Irish Elvis fan club member. I was card carrying. I had like a laminated card from when I was 6 weeks old.
Really?
So, like, I know Elvis fans from like, you know, the Irish Elvis fan club, and they're pretty obsessive people, you know.
And is there a particular Elvis or period of Elvis that you like more than another?
Well, I really love like young Elvis, like early Elvis, and you know when he had those really strong kind of R&B influences, and there was something really raw. And like, I really love Elvis's charisma, and actually like Elvis as this kind of like, really charismatic and like quite beautiful person, you know. I feel like there's something like quite fragile about that early Elvis, like there's something quite uncorrupted by the rest of like his life and the world and fame that kind of would have happened later. And I think there's something about the younger Elvis that really appeals to me. And, you know, I suppose his kind of film work as well wouldn't be some of my favourite stuff. But when I was a kid, I would have been raised on Elvis movies. So, you know, Elvis wasn't just a sound. Elvis was like a character in my living room. You know, every part of Elvis was in my life, not just the music.
In fact, your first musical choice, I knew it would be Elvis. I was curious to see what it would be. And it is from the movie, period.
Yeah.
A song called One Night With You. You know, the song was originally called One Night of Sin.
I can imagine.
The New Orleans version.
The
New Orleans version was a bit more upfront about what was on the cards.
It feels like that.
All right, well, here comes One Night, Elvis Presley. One Night with You, Elvis Presley. They're the first choice of Jessie Presley Jones, the artist who is with us in studio tonight, picking all the music. I knew Elvis would be your first choice. I'm just curious to see which Elvis you'd go for. And that's from the movies, but it's pretty raunchy too, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Jessie, you mentioned Inchicore, St. Michael's Estate.
Yeah.
How long were you there?
I suppose I was born there, and then we would have moved out to Talla in the early days of the great exodus out to Tala in the early 80s. But I suppose Elvis is such a strong part of St. Michael's Estate for me in my mind. And I remember my mum telling me that the night that Elvis died, there just everybody from the Elvis fan club in Dublin just started to move towards St. Michael's Estate on buses or walking and everything. And my ma was very heavily pregnant, but had about 40 people in the house for 3 days for an Elvis wake, you know, so singing and having this very strong on the 10th floor of St. Michael's Estate, this 3 day Elvis marathon of singing and crying. And, you know, it was like people lost a member of their family.
Was there any particular reason that it was all happening there? Or,
well, that's what my dad would have been really involved in the Elvis fan club, and he used to organise gigs and film screenings in Rathmines. And, you know, he would have been one of the people who rented the 16mm Elvis films for the Elvis fan club parties. And it was actually when we moved out of St. Michael's Estate, because we got a house in Tala, and there was a thing around the time of the housing crisis in the early 80s that if the word got out that you had gotten a house, as you were moving your stuff, like somebody would find out that the house was free, so you could kind of get in the door and hatch it. So you keep it so the council can't kick you out. So lots of kind of younger people were doing this who didn't have a chance of getting a house. And we were moving our stuff out to Tala, and we came back the next morning and two fellas had broken into the flat in Inchicore. And my dad was like banging on the door and everything. But all you see is out the window is coming all the Elvis records and the 16mm film coming down. And it was just this sense of like, oh my God, no, Elvis is coming out the window. Like, it was all this precious stuff. But I suppose it's very, that my relationship with Elvis has really kind of impacted a kind of Dublin inner city life as well in a strange way.
Yeah. Tala, the mood to Tala at the time, must have been quite exciting, was it? Because it was yeah. a big change, yeah. Big shift.
Oh, we thought we won the lotto getting out to Tala, because there was a garden. And, you know, I mean, like, it's hard to realise now, because, you know, we think of like housing as something that you really have to like fight for. It's like almost like you're almost embarrassed if you get a place to live, you know, if you can turn the key somewhere. But like, I remember going out to Tala with my brother, and we were very young, but we were walking around brand new housing estates and we were told to pick which house we wanted to be in. You know, it was that feeling of like public housing was like a provision that the state did.
The expression the Wild West actually comes to mind.
Yeah,
you know?
It still is.
This is all yours, take what you want.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was. It does have that, you know. I remember the first time I went to LA, I remember talking to my friends about Tala and they were like, that sounds like here, you know, that sense of something just being so westerly. There's a kind of psychic west.
And you know the way people, all of us, you talk to people all the time. So I remember this when it was all green fields. People say that about everywhere. But you probably do remember Tala when it was all green fields.
Yeah, I definitely do. And it's actually not that long ago. Mm. Like, I would have been a teenager when Tala was green fields, actually. There's a great book that my friend Lisa turned me on to, Malachy Horan Remembers. And it's this guy who was born the year of the famine. And he talks about Tala in like the 1840s and 50s. And some of the stories be amazing. But they seem, there's something quintessentially Tala about them as well. Mm. Like one of the stories was how his father decided who would get to own the house based on who could throw a dead dog the furthest. And the son that threw the dead dog the furthest got to inherit the family property.
Fair enough. At least the dog was dead. No. Your next musical choice, speaking of which, is Big Mama Thornton.
Yeah.
Singing a song about a very alive dog. Why choose this? Because I have to say, I loved the moment when I discovered songs like Elvis Presley songs had been done before by other people. And it's kind of an exciting moment to find out there's a whole layer of stuff underneath.
Yeah.
So when did you discover Big Mama Thornton?
I suppose it was actually true, like when I was a teenager, to like Janis Joplin. So Janis Joplin, like Elvis, would have covered her songs and covered Ball and Chain and stuff. So finding like Big Mama was true, Janis Joplin and that big female voice. Mm. But then realising that she originally recorded Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog was like, oh my God, of course I love her. She's incredible.
All right, here comes Big Mama Thornton. You ain't nothing but a Big Mama Thornton there, and Hound Dog, the second choice of Jesse Jones, a big Elvis Presley fan. So were the parents, so much so that Jesse's middle name is Presley. So Jesse Presley Jones, the best named artist in Ireland. We're going to talk about the art practice in a while, but we've just been talking about growing up there, Jesse, in Inchicore, first of all, then Tala. First signs of an artistic bent, do you think? What happened?
I suppose art was always in my house. So, I mean, my dad was really good at drawing. He really had a skill at it. So we would just like clear the kitchen table and be drawing using markers, paints. It was always just like, I wouldn't have been to an art gallery or a museum until, God, I think the first art gallery I was in was, that was showing art, was in MoMA in New York. Like, we wouldn't have gone into the Hugh Lane, or we wouldn't have done anything like that. I think there would have been a level of like intimidation about art, but we were always sitting around the table doing it.
Where did your dad get that from, do you think? Had he had any classes or lessons, or completely self-taught?
Do you know, he actually got it. It's interesting, the Elvis connection, because I reckon he got it because he was such a fan of Elvis, and he, you know, organised all these Elvis fan club events and screenings and everything. Somebody had to make the posters and put it all together. And I think when you're an obsessive fan of somebody, you'll just, you know, you'll break through that kind of fear of or inhibition. So he would be drawing Elvis posters and, you know, even movie posters, he'd replicate them because there was no mimeographic or internet machine or so he'd draw them, you know.
So when you're a kid and you're sitting around the table with the markers, what are you drawing? Just endless portraits of Elvis Presley, I suppose.
No, I would. I remember, do you know what? I actually remember the first time I was obsessed with a drawing I made. I was drawn, but, you know, my brothers were drawn too. So, like, it wasn't a special thing to be good at art in the family. But I remember I drew this, like, picture of, like, a replication that I had seen of a Native American. And it was, like, this mountainous landscape and, like, really kind of dreamlike. And I remember drawing that and painting this when I was about 9 or 10 or something. And I just remember being obsessed with, like, oh, my God, the effect of, like, making this thing has been incredible. That was when I just knew that I loved art.
And did school have any bearing on this at all?
See, in school it was quite funny because, like, because in my home everybody did art. I didn't think it was anything special, but in school everybody's like, "Oh, you're good at drawing. Will you do my art homework?" And I got good at drawing really quickly when I went to secondary school, because if my teacher from secondary school, Miss White, can hear this now, I'll probably still get into trouble. But whenever we would have art homework, everybody would just get me to do it on the lunch break. So I would, like, be churning out, you know, like, still lifes of peppers and apples. And I think I got really good really quickly.
That's good training. Good training.
It was like a little gulag or something.
And you said you weren't at any art galleries. You know, by that I mean the National Gallery in Dublin or Hugh Lane or anywhere like that. Was there anywhere else where you were able to find out about art, or was it still just an internal thing for you?
I reckon my real beginning love of art was being affected by cinema. You know, my family were big film buffs, so we would sit and watch films on the television or go to the cinema. And I reckon, like, before I knew there was, like, an art world, I was just obsessed with, you know, film is, like, one of my mediums, of course, you know. So I reckon that it was actually film and really being affected by cinema that really opened up the possibility that art was something within the world that I was really drawn to.
And presumably you went to see just about everything that was appropriate for you to get in to see, I suppose. Just all sorts of movies. You weren't being particularly selective as a younger person, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I suppose I went to see everything. And, like, what I really loved was, like, Sunday matinee musicals and things like that. I kind of loved old movies and, like, movies that, you know, would be on in the daytime and you just, like, go down the wormhole or, like, go down the rabbit hole with, like, you know, Gone with the Wind or something. I did really, really like older films, and I really liked a lot of, like, American 1950s cinema and that really gritty kind of, like, you know, urban realist kind of style. I loved all those Elia Kazan movies from the 50s, and that's really as well how I got very into music was true, films as well. So, you know, I would hear like maybe like Billie Holiday, or I'd see Paul Robeson in Showboat, and, you know, that would kind of spark me to like, oh, I need to find out more about them. That's a thing, you know.
You mentioned two people there already who are on your list. So yeah, before we go any further, let's start with Paul Robeson before we leave Ireland altogether here. People might be surprised to know that Paul Robeson recorded this song. They might be equally surprised to know that Leonard Cohen sang it, that Hank Loughlin sang it, and Lonnie Donegan sang it. Ronnie Donegan recorded it as well. This is Paul Robeson singing a song you might know. As Bono would say, this is a rebel song. Great Paul Robeson there singing Kevin Barry, the choice of Jesse Jones, who's with me in studio. Where'd you hear that first? Because the first time I heard it, at that point, I hadn't realised that Paul Robeson had recorded that song. It's on an album, I think, called Struggles, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, Paul Robeson has always been somebody who I've loved for a really long time. But I heard a great story about how he learned this song, and it was through Padder O'Donnell, an Irish Republican socialist whose car had broken down, and this limousine is driving by, and he gets out of the car, it's Paul Robeson, and he's, you know, helping him, giving him a lift and all. And he's like, oh, I always wanted to record an Irish song. And Padder O'Donnell goes, you need to record a proper Republican anthem. You need to record Kevin Barry. And that's the song really? That he ended up recording. But he wanted to learn Irish and everything, you know. He was really, he just seen this kind of solidarity between like Irish experience and the Black American experience that is incredibly moving, actually, you know.
Jesse, you mentioned a moment ago, we might as well play it now, you mentioned Billie Holiday. Tell me a little bit about why Billie Holiday appeals to you.
See, this song now, if I had to pick a song that I've listened to most of my whole life, it is this song. And I, like, even to this day, I don't know why, but I still listen to it. There's something new in it every single time. And I think, you know, her voice is incredible. It was the first time I really became obsessed with a singer in my own right. You know, growing up, Elvis was always in the house, but Billie Holiday, you know, I found completely by myself, and she was like the person who was my Elvis, you know. So like my dad would paint and do the drawings of Elvis, I would do loads of drawings of Billie Holiday, because, you know, this was the 90s. You couldn't go out and get a poster of Billie Holiday. So I had to get good at drawing her in order to have this, you know, teenage paraphernalia everywhere. So I think, you know, this song, even though it's obviously recorded in like the 1940s, is like the song of my teenage years, just sitting in my bedroom and being obsessed with wanting to be an artist and loving this song so much, and the kind of sense of like yearning that's in it is just really powerful to me.
Okay, Billie Holiday, I Cover the Waterfront. Billie Holiday, I Cover the Waterfront, the choice of Jesse Jones, who's with me in studio picking all the music tonight. Jesse, when did you first go to art college, or where did you go?
I actually went to Ballyferma to do a PLC course. And from there, I went to NCD. And that was just like such an incredible moment. I met like the person who was my best friend to this day there. And it was like, actually, I was quite like a shy person. And going to art school really kind of opened me up, and because I felt like I could be confident about who I was there, because the thing that I was so obsessed with, which was art, I was surrounded by people who were obsessed with that as well. So I didn't feel, I know a lot of people talk about going to art school to feel less like a freak, but it actually is true. You know, imagine being obsessed with something and being, you know, kept away from the other people who are obsessed with it, and then finding them, and then you're just like, wow.
Why did you apply to art college? Why did you want to go?
I reckon I didn't really think too much about it, because it wasn't like there was a load of kind of careery stuff in my family. My family were not really career kind of like education driven people. It was like, find your way to be happy in the world and be, you know, have a decent life. So it was kind of, everything was kind of wide open to me because there wasn't really those kind of academic expectations. So when I heard there was such a place as art school, it's like being told that there's like this Disneyland and it's free to go to it. And, you know, I was really lucky because when I went to art school, it was the year after they abolished fees. And that had such a huge impact on, like, you know, me as a working class person to be able to access that, you know. And I think I think things are very different now. I think I was very lucky, but it's kind of one of those things that you fall into the right moment in time where this thing that would not have been available to you 5 years before or even 10 years after, it's just for this little crack in time is available.
Well,
you know?
Access is important. I mean, you've represented this country officially, the Venice Biennale and other places. You've represented this country. And as you say, a couple of years either side and you wouldn't have been able to go to our college in the first place.
Yeah. Which isn't, you know, it kind of makes you realise, like, who are the people who are being excluded now, are really important voices that should have a way to kind of experience that kind of education, you know.
How long were you at our college until you got a kind of a grip on something particular that might have been your own, do you think? Or maybe that happened afterwards, I don't know.
I think it kind of happened afterwards. I think, you know, when I was in art school, I was surrounded by people who are all brilliant at art as well. You know, I kind of always feel like I've been in very lucky situations to be surrounded by people who are great at what they did. So I never felt that what I did was in any way different or exceptional. So possibly still don't think that. But I think the time when I knew there was no going back from the experience of being an artist would have been, I suppose, when I finished art school. And it was actually a video work that I made that I knew that this was the kind of work I wanted to make. And this Everton almost crystallised for me was when I made a very simple video work, which was based on the waterfront and on Leonard Bernstein's score for On the Waterfront. And I asked three young musicians to play the symphonic suite from On the Waterfront in Sean Tracy house, just in the courtyard. And it just kind of synthesized for me this feeling I had about cinema and this feeling I had about class and community and what were these kind of like micro kind of epic moments in ordinary life and how art could in some way open that up. So I think that was the moment when it wasn't so much about my work, but it was about the realisation that, you know, there's something about art that feels completely necessary for me in the way I understand the whole of my life.
Were you the kind of person who was really desperate to express herself, to express yourself somehow?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't be getting up doing a song around.
Yeah, but people do it in different ways, you know. Some people write poems and some people paint and some people sing and some people form bands and some, you know, there's things you can do at that age, you know, to. But, you know, you, not only were you good at art, though, you had things to say, you know. You wanted to express what was going on around you. I would have been quite politically active, actually.
I would have been quite politically active in the early 2000s, and I was involved in the anti-capitalist movement. I was involved in student politics, left student politics, and went to Genoa to the very famed anti-capitalist moment that happened there in 2001. And, you know, that the feeling of like struggling to articulate something was always got to do for me with not myself but justice, and like feeling that something was happening that I felt was really wrong, and finding kind of solidarities with other people to kind of rally against that.
Because there's a line that always gets used to describe your work, and it always says, it sounds kind of, you know, it's art language, but still it's comprehensible. That your work reflects and represents historical moments of collective resistance and dissent. That's kind of at the heart of what you do. Is that still valid?
Yeah,
that line?
I suppose that line actually does really reflect on that way of thinking about that first artwork that really moved me to make, that I was really moved to make around On the Waterfront. It's, you know, what are those kind of like moments when things can have another possibility? Mm. And how can we re-enter those moments, not as nostalgia, but to just inhabit them again through art and kind of go, what does it feel like to be on this stage, or what does it feel like to be in on this demonstration or in this therapy session or at this exact moment when things could be different in the world? Like, how do we kind of push out the boundaries of that to change the way we live our lives now, you know?
Okay, we'll come back to that in a moment. Next musical choice is Karen Dalton. Which song do you want from Karen?
Something's On Your Mind.
Something's On Your Mind. Karen Dalton. Karen Dalton there, and the choice of Jesse Jones is with me in the studio picking all the tracks. You're right, Jesse, she sounds a bit like Billie Holiday. She's very like Billie Holiday, in fact. And we were talking a little bit about your practice there, and it's for people who don't move in those particular circles, it might seem, and still even at this stage, seem kind of strange, because people understand what a painter does, what a sculptor does. But when you work with installation, with video, with film, it's very hard to figure out exactly how you function, because video. I mean, can you sell it? Can you hang it on a wall? You can't. You know. What do you do with it? Does it only exist when it's on in a gallery? It's still much misunderstood, I think, or indeed not understood at all, perhaps.
But that's kind of like theatre, though. You know, it's like it exists when it's performed. Mm. It's kind of like a play. So I do feel my work is very accessible, though. I think, you know, when people experience it, they do feel some kind of relationship to it. And I don't think it's, you know, I do a lot of research and sometimes I sound really intellectual. But I think that, you know, fundamentally, I want to make work that people can connect with and that moves them, or, you know, moves them to question something about the world that I'm searching as well for.
That's a good point, because I think it's the kind of work that's very hard to talk about, very hard to describe.
You have to kind of experience it, really.
And it's not at all hard to experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I've seen many of your films and they're always, you know, they're always immersive and interesting and enjoyable a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Particularly because there's a lot of music is at the core.
Music's a big part of it, really.
You use music quite a lot.
Yeah.
Just to give an example of some of the musical collaborations you've done, and give somebody an idea of the kind of work that you've done, anybody who hasn't seen your work. I mean, you've worked with marching bands, you've worked with opera singers, you've worked with theremin players. We'll save that to the end, I think, the theremin. Tell me about the work you did with, say, the marching band. What did you do?
Yeah, well, I always wanted to work with the Artane Boys Band, and
And it was so specifically the Artane Boys you wanted to work with, as opposed to a marching band.
Well, I was really thinking of the Artane Boys Band in relationship to the north side of Dublin, and how, you know, they have this very complex history around the industrial school. But the passion of a group of young people to pick up an instrument, and, you know, there's something really distilled about the Artane Boys Band in terms of the musicians. And I was making a project in Ballymun, and it just felt really appropriate to kind of ask them to make a soundtrack. So they made Dus Spake Zarathustra and performed it inside of an abandoned swimming pool. So, you know, the relationship between music and the cinematic as a way of kind of just breaking time or turning time into something spectacular. You know, it's like when you're standing at a bus stop in the rain and, you know, you put on Maria Callas and you're like, you could be anywhere. So music has, for me, music has this ability to just transport the very ordinary, banal reality of life into something quite amazing and uncanny. And also, like, there's a sadness to that as well, because there's these two parallel ways of experiencing the world. And I think, I suppose, with a lot of the music today that I selected, I was thinking about what's inside of those songs, and inside a lot of the songs I selected today is almost like characters and stories who are using the music as a way to break into this other space of, like, recognition for for to cover the waterfront for this recognition of finding this love, or to kind of reach out to people through music is really important.
Jimmy Scott is your next choice.
Yeah, I love this song.
We could talk about Jimmy Scott for days. Most fascinating man, extraordinary.
See,
man.
You met him, John, so I'm so jealous of you.
Yeah, back in the day.
Yeah.
Where did you hear Jimmy first,
I reckon it was through my friend Mark Palmer, who played it one time, and I just remember thinking, who's this? Oh my God. This feeling when you hear a singer like Jimmy Scott for the first time, it just changes everything that you think about music.
When you see someone like him or you hear someone like him, does it make you think about your own practice? And the question is this, when Jimmy Scott stood on the stage with his arms outspread and the suit was too big for him, and this voice came out of this little figure, and he's crying and the audience is crying.
Yeah.
You start to think, most artists are wasting their time. You're never going to get there.
Yeah.
You're never going to achieve what this man is doing.
When I think about him like that, when you describe him like that, it reminds me so much of like a performer like Alwyn Fure, and that sense of like somebody, it's them, but it's also, they're a conduit for something coming through them. There's a channeling going on with Jimmy Scott that I think is really incredible. There's, to overuse the phrase shamanic, there's something about him that is almost, he's as frail and small as his stature is, he's bigger than all the parts of a human put together, because he has this way of channeling something from beyond.
But when you see that, for real, you realise that a lot of the stuff you've seen before isn't there. It's not at that level.
It's a clarifier, isn't it?
Okay, Jimmy Scott, Time on My Hands. Jimmy Scott there, Time on My Hands, the choice of Jesse Jones, who's with me in studio. Something, isn't he?
That song is just perfection.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when he came to Ireland, he was in that run he had before he passed away. He had run a number of years where he was sort of back, and playing big gigs and all the rest of it. And it was great to see that he got that opportunity, because for a lot of his life he was working as a janitor. He was completely forgotten, totally forgotten. Anyway, Jesse, what was your first big moment as a professional artist, do you think, that really kind of... You mentioned earlier on there was a point where there's no going back.
Yeah.
But as a full time artist, what was the first thing that happened that kind of just confirmed it, that this is my job now?
I think I was very lucky in my 20s to kind of have situations happen that probably wouldn't happen for a young artist now, because it was during the boom and people had put a punt on you and stuff, But I did a project called 12 Angry Films, and it was a drive-in cinema down in the Docklands, and I think that was the moment when I had a public audience that came to the work. Before that, I think a lot of things were shown in kind of like smaller artist-run galleries, and there would have been about 10 people that saw the work, or if you were lucky, 40 people that saw it. But having like a large public audience for the work, that an audience that wouldn't necessarily go to an artwork, an audience that were kind of interested in the drive-in because of the politics. So the drive-in cinema showed films that I made with a group of people over the course of a year that explored social justice and migrancy in Ireland, and they were in six different languages. And I suppose that was the first time that I felt that making work, I could have like a community around me, and it could build into something that the public would want to see,
Because you must have realised quite early on that the kind of work you wanted to do was going to be complicated to realise.
Mm.
These projects, you would need other people.
And resources and time. Yeah.
Which means money most of the time, and venues. And, it's not just, like another artist who could be working out of their garage, and painting and sending them out into the world.
Yeah.
You'd never regretted getting into that territory where you thought, this is a handful here.
See, because I'm really interested in like collective culture and the way we experience the world, you know, in terms of a collective understanding of reality, whether that be popular culture or politics or music, of course, it kind of goes with the territory that I have to make things that generate that as well. You know, I can't just riff on a drive-in cinema and just like make it out the back garden in my house. Like I have to, it has to be a drive-in. You have to get people driving up in their cars and turning on the radio. And when you have them, then you give them the hard politics, the politics that's hard to take. So you're kind of mobilizing pleasure or, you know, pop culture to communicate with people something that they mightn't be as ready to commune with, you know?
What about old-fashioned politics? Did that ever appeal? I mean, some people communicate by standing on a box and delivering
like
a speech.
Like to be a politician.
Yeah. No. Deliver a speech. Well, not a politician, but you're, you know, an activist.
I am known to give a speech,
say.
Yeah.
An activist, let's say. But you know what I mean? There may be more direct routes. You know, handing out flyers might be more effective. I don't know. You know, making a speech from a bedroom window might be more effective. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you find your way with politics and you find your way as an artist. And those two roads kind of led to the same place for me, which was, you know, there's something about the magic and the mystery of art that feels really, politics feels different through that lens, or feels, you know, I want to create experiences for people that make them question the way reality is perceived, and in that you can adventure into a space of politics, you know.
Well, certainly it provides room for imagination and possibility that doesn't always exist in normal political dialogue. You know, there's not much nuance a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, like for me as an artist over the last couple of years, being able to explore really tough themes around feminism through art has been really important, because you can gather people together and create an experience for them that shows that things can be otherwise in this kind of imaginary of art. You can stage things in art. I mean, a work I made two years ago in the Hugh Lane, No More Fun and Games, kind of staged this imaginary feminist institution. And by staging that for, you know, 5 months and inviting people in and kind of asking them to question the history of art, then you can kind of come away from that differently. Mm. You can kind of come away from that and go, well, why is the history of art written in that way? Why do we have to always compensate for, you know, the blind sight of history?
And as you said, doing it in the kind of way you did it is much more effective than reading a chapter about it in a book. Well, for me, it would be.
Mm.
You know, the experience sort of frees your mind, doesn't it? It opens you up a bit.
Yeah, and it exposes you to other people who are also thinking that. So it creates kind of collective space as well, you know.
I want to talk more about that collective thing, because you've used that word over and over again. That's so important to you. Let's talk about that. But we'll put another musical choice first. Now, we're not going to play all of this because it's too long.
Mm.
Well, actually, no, we can play all this, because it's the first part of A Love Supreme that you want. And this is the part called Acknowledgement. So this is possibly my favourite piece of music in the world ever as well.
Really?
John Coltrane. And that's part one of A Love Supreme from John Coltrane. The choice of Jesse Jones is with me in studio. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more music chosen tonight by Jesse Jones. And this is Mystery Train, RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special. Tonight, the music has been picked by the artist Jesse Jones. Jesse, really loving the music so far. One of the words, I said to come back to this, you keep using the word collective.
Mm.
Tell me more about that, because you like working with other people, but you also like to create a collective experience as well. It's a group experience.
Like in the gallery.
Yeah.
I suppose, I mean, there's kind of, for me, art is like a quest or a feeling that, you know, you're trying to get towards something. And, you know, I think a lot of focus on art is around like the individual and, you know, the individual genius or author, or, you know, there's something exceptional about this person and their expression. And I actually think that the thing that really compels me to think about art is to find the thing beyond the self. And for me, maybe I default use the word collective, but, you know, I think for me it's something about the, there's something beyond your own experiences in life that you're trying to find a way towards, you know. So when I say it, I kind of say it in terms of like politics and in terms of like how we agree to live in the world together, but I also mean it in terms of an ancestral collective or a way of thinking about the future and how we might have to be responsible for what kind of reality we produce for generations to come, you know. So when I say the collective, I just mean it in terms of like an opposition to this kind of way of thinking only through the self. Which is kind of such a dominant thing in art, but it's just such a dominant thing in capitalism. And, you know, it's become so accepted that even to speak about the collective, everybody thinks that you're like a radical communist. But that's the way most humans have always felt, is that we were on a quest towards something together, you know?
Musicians talk like that sometimes. I've interviewed musicians who talk the way you've just... who speak the way you've just spoken about.
Well, musicians
things, you
know? Make experiences. Yeah. So I can kind of relate to that, even though I don't have a musical bone in my body. But I can kind of relate to that sense of like music is a way of staging some kind of experience that becomes kind of mystical in the moment it happens, you know?
And that does happen. I mean, if you're at a good concert, yeah, a good gig, there's all, and it might only be a moment, but yeah, something inevitably happens at some point where everybody is kind of connected up. It's not just a solo experience. And yeah, it comes from the artist in his or her room by his or herself initially, but it spreads out, doesn't it?
Yeah. But it's like that thing about being a conjugate again, you know, you're almost like you're using your body and your voice to kind of connect with people, and you're channeling something, you know. It might be coming from the cosmos, but, you know, it's coming out through, you're transmitting.
I've heard singers talk about channeling. This is dark territory. Now, I've heard singers talk about channeling people who have gone before.
Yeah.
How do you feel about
like
that?
Like a seance kind of.
Yeah.
I think we're always in some way connected to channeling what has gone before. I think, you know, we live with the dead, we just don't recognise it. And I think that we're surrounded by spirits, and we're surrounded by, you know, a collective. But I think there's been some kind of disconnect that we've adapted to, which makes us think that we are special and we are here and we are living and sentient beings, when actually there's something else in the atmosphere as well, which is collective, and it might be in the spirit realm. Sometimes it's called the knowing field. I'd be quite spiritual, but also esoteric as well in my thinking, you know.
I suppose, you see, when most of us have trouble feeling connected in the present,
yeah,
it's difficult to think about being connected to the past and the future as well,
yeah,
you know?
I think you can kind of allow yourself to just get transported to that place. It just is something that has evolved in my consciousness as I got older, that, you know, people have passed and you feel that you're still connected to them, you know? Like my Aunt Kathleen, when she passed away, I think that had a big impact on my life, because it made me realise that, like, that can't be gone. It has to really still be there, you know?
Do you want to play the song now?
Yeah, actually, good timing.
Yeah.
This is Kathleen Bride.
This is your aunt?
Yeah.
When the routine bites hard and ambitions are
gone. So, Jesse, that was your late aunt, Kathleen. And what age was she when she sang that?
I think she was about 73. And we were in her kitchen in Coolock. in Bunratty Drive, and I was life modelling around the corner in Colosh to Doolig, and I was having my lunch in her house every lunchtime, and she was making me mackerel and mash, which is one of my favourite dinners. But I played the song for her because I always loved her voice. I thought she sounded like, you know, Jimmy Scott, or she had that kind of like, you know, in a kind of Gardiner Street, Dublin working class way, she had this way of singing a jazz standard that was so beautiful. But I really wanted her to sing Joy Division, and she wasn't into it. I played it for her. She was like, oh no, that's nice. But when she read the lyrics, she was like, oh, that's very powerful. That's a great story. Yeah. And I think she connected to the storytelling of that Joy Division song. And then, you know, she did a beautiful version of it.
But it sounds like it's on a record.
Yeah, I actually was making an installation in Boer in County Offaly around 2004 or something. And I recorded the theremin, Lydia Kavina on the theremin. And on the other side, the record, there was just space. So I said, I never intended to make, you know, to have it as part of an artwork, but there was space on the other side, the record. So it was like classic B-side, put it on.
Put your auntie on the
bass. So I would have it, you know.
Your references so far have all been, not your musical references, but your geographical ones have been Inchicore, Tala, Gardiner Street. When did you first set foot in New York City? Because that changed things as well. I mean, that's a
Well, that was the first art gallery I went to,
The first time you were in an art gallery was in New York.
It was in MoMA, yeah.
So when was that?
We would have went over. Now, there was a thing in the late 90s where you got 2-for-1 flights with Aer Lingus or something if you collect Super Quinn vouchers. So all of our family ended up over in New York City in the late 90s. And I think, you know, it nearly broke Aer Lingus, that deal that they did. But we ended up over there, and I loved it. My brothers hated it, but I loved it. And actually, Auntie Kathleen was with us as well. And she wasn't a big fan of New York, but I loved it. And then 2 years later, I went back on my own and did the J1 there, and got a job in like a fashion house, and, you know, would go down to like Smalls and go to the Village Vanguard. And, you know, I really loved, like, it was my first kind of being away from home. And it was like all this accumulation of the love of jazz and this exposure to modern art, not even contemporary art. You know, I was going to see Picasso and de Kooning in MoMA, and that was like a big exposure to modern art as well. So
it was really, you literally had not seen anything like that before.
No, I hadn't. You know, I hadn't been to an exhibition. The first time I went to IMME was to see an exhibition by Jim Henson and the Muppets, and that was amazing. That was amazing. they took over the Royal Hospital Kilmainham to do an expose or an expo on the Muppets, and that was that would work as contemporary art now, though, you
of
know.
Of course it would, yeah.
But that was great. But I hadn't, you know, like being out in Tala, there wasn't a gallery to go into town to kind of cross the threshold. Our school didn't bring us. Our school never brought us into a gallery. So it kind of, you know, I found my way to art independently.
What appealed to you most in those New York, the big New York galleries? I mean, you mentioned Picasso and de Kooning and all. You would have seen the Jackson Pollocks and things like that that are sort of the star attractions in places like that. What most affected you, do you think?
I think what really most affected me in New York was actually the city itself. You know, I mean, like, I still get like chills when I travel on the subway in New York. And I remember feeling that, you know, it was a place where I felt like I could be an artist because you could be so anonymous. It's, you know, you could take risks. And I remember one time I would just, because I worked in Midtown, and every day when I was going on the subway, I'd make a little gesture, like a little performative gesture. Like I'd make a costume, like a skirt made of maps, or, you know, I'd just do something every day. Just to kind of clock in with my sense of being an artist in this very anonymous way, you know. And I remember one time I was on the subway and somebody asked me, was I an artist? And it was that first moment where somebody could recognise that in me, that I just went, yeah, I am, you know. And it was great because I think going to New York on your own when you're like 21, it's just such a great thing to do. I don't know whether it would be now with like Donald Trump and everything, but like definitely for me, for like my kind of like journey or quest to be an artist, going there to do the J1 was like a really big part of it for me, you know.
Next musical choice, Jessie, where are we at? Bill Withers.
Yeah, love this. We're back in
We're back in the family again here. Here we go. Grandma's Hands from Bill Withers, the choice of Jessie Jones. Strange, Jessie, you said earlier on that you haven't a musical bone in your body, but yet love for music, it's all through your work. So by that, maybe you just mean that you don't play an instrument or something.
Yeah.
I was in your studio a couple of years ago, I forget when it was now, just before you went to Venice, and you had a lot of books on the shelf, really interesting books, and you said there were references, you know, they were there for reference. They were to do with the work you were doing.
Mm.
And I'm wondering, does music serve the same purpose? Do you have musical references when you're working? Is it music that you listen to, or is it music that you go and seek out when you're in the middle of a project?
Yeah, I often kind of feel like I can hear a work before I can see it, you know? So I can feel the atmosphere. And for a long time, you know, I knew that the atmosphere of the work I was making was really connected to the theremin, and working with Lydia was a very strong way of creating a vibration. And the vibration of the theremin almost like connected me to a world of images that I could then plug into.
So this, we might as well play this piece of music now, maybe. This piece with the theremin, tell me about it and tell me where it started. Did it start with you discovering this instrument called a theremin? Or did it start with another idea and you thought, this needs a theremin?
Mm. I reckon I actually was really, I loved Cornelius Cardew for a really long time. And I, you know, I loved the way he felt and thought about music. And I suppose it makes sense in terms of not being a musical person, but loving that malleability of things like the scratch orchestra, that, you know, it's actually a sculptural thing. And I think when I heard the theremin first, I was thinking about it through that kind of scratch orchestra possibility of it being this thing that you almost touch, but you don't quite. And it feels like you're making a drawing with your hand, or you're kind of conjuring. I would have heard it so much in film and cinema and horror movies.
Yeah, it was the soundtrack of the Cold War, yeah, really, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It really,
like,
was.
It's chilling. Yeah. It's chilling, you know.
And so what did you do then? What did you do next? You thought, right, you've got these ideas, you've got this theremin. You actually went and sought out the theremin
Lydia.
Player.
Yeah, Lydia's incredible. So when I was looking into the history of the theremin, because, you know, I'm a total nerd. If I become obsessed with something, I have to know everything about it and, you know, find out things about it that just feel quite psychedelic or trippy, just in their minutiae of detail. But then finding Lydia and realising that, you know, she learned from Leon Theremin when he was under house arrest how to play the theremin. Just those kind of flukes of history that somebody ends up, Leon Theremin invented the theremin instrument. But
didn't he teach Lennon or something?
Lennon wanted to learn how to play it because Leon Theremin brought it to Lennon.
This is not John Lennon, this is
Lennon. It's not John Lennon. It's kind of a bigger deal, Lennon.
Yeah.
But he really wanted to learn how to play it. And Leon Theremin brought it to Lennon. And that's just one of the greatest moments in kind of like musical history. Lennon and theremin, you know, riffing on this piece of electro in the early part of the 20th century, you know.
So you've got the theremin, you've got the player.
Yeah.
What did you do next? But tell me about the venue, because I've seen this film and it's beautiful.
Oh, this is the Spectre and the Sphere. Yeah, so actually this was a work I made 10 years ago, and I contacted Lydia Kavina, and I really just very simply wanted to make a recording. Originally, it was just to make a recording of the Internationale, the famous, you know, socialist anthem about collectivity and kind of possibility in music, to have that recorded on the theremin and to try and kind of disrupt that story of the theremin being connected to the Cold War and kind of give it another story. And Lydia really liked the idea, and we managed to get her over to Dublin and record her performing it. And I remember the first time I seen her play theremin, I had just collected her from the airport and we, you know, got her in a cab and brought her to Project. And in a way, the theremin was in my imagination rather than I hadn't even thought about how it would actually work. So when Lydia set it up and everything, I remember the first time she played it, it was like watching a magic trick. I was just like, oh my God, that's actually what happens. It's actually real. And she played the Internationale really kind of like straight. And then it was like finding that kind of amorphous metaphysical place that the theremin can occupy and just kind of pushing into that area, you know.
Because this is an instrument, if anybody, you will have heard the theremin if you haven't seen one, because it is in a lot of sci-fi movies and all of that. But there's a sort of an antenna and you move your hands around, but you don't actually touch it.
But it sounds like voice, sounds, it's like it's quite vocal. The piece that I chose to play today is a Bach piece, actually. I think it's so incredibly beautiful to hear the theremin playing, you know, like a 16th century German choral score. There's something about it that's very hypnotic, and you know, this sense of time being completely shattered, that it's almost like a kind of futuristic version of the 16th century to hear the theremin interpret that choral music.
Okay, here it comes. Jesse Jones in studio tonight, picking all the tunes, and that's Lydia Kavina, the theremin player, playing music by Bach. Gorgeous, that. Gorgeous. What's the single thing that would have changed you most in the last, I don't know, 5 years?
I think I went to Korea a few years ago, and I think that really did change. It just kind of solidified stuff for me, you know. I think being on the other side of the world and, you know, being completely on your own, a lot of times as an artist you are on your own, and you do have to kind of, I know that writers talk about that as well, that kind of being aloneness or the loneliness of being a writer or an artist as well can really shape what you go to access in your work. And I think that actually being in Korea, being in Korea is a very beautiful place, but also you can feel the vibration, the ancestral vibrations there. And, you know, you can feel something when you're in Korea around this vibration of the north. And, you know, it definitely brought that sense of things being unfinished. Like, history is always unfinished.
When you say you feel ancestral vibrations, I'm not being smart here now, but is that not just your own sense of tension being there? I'm sure they're connected, but you know, you're in a place where you know there's a problem, so maybe it's internal as opposed to an external force.
I think it's something that Korean people talk about a lot, you know, that sense of in Korea you always get buried beside your ancestors for 19 generations, you know, and there's a definite connection with the ancestral in terms of everyday life that is, it's just acknowledged to be so. I think that was the thing, that spending a lot of time there and making strong connections there with friends and people that I worked with. The other interesting thing was how much I had in common with them, you know. And you know, I made an artwork there, and a way of communicating the work to the performers was talking about it in relationship to Beckett and Irish theatre, and they just got it straight away, because, you know, the Irish theatre was huge in Korea in the 1920s and 30s.
Was,
you know,
it? Yeah.
Yeah, they translated Sean O'Casey in the 30s, and, you know, they were going through a relationship to colonisation, that Irish art and culture was such a great way to articulate experience, political experience for people. So, you know, there was just such a strong affinity, even though you were the other side of the world. It was this thing that bound you to history and experience together in the same way.
That's a great thing about travelling. I suspect if you said to most people
wonderful.
Today, which country in the world do you think you would have least in common with? And they might say Korea. And yet,
yeah, go
and
there
it,
though.
And it turns out, out that they know all of our plays.
Yeah, well, like, I think, you know, there's this thing in Korea called Han, and it's always really hard to explain what Han is. And I think there's something very similar in Irish culture, which is around this sense of a grief that's unpassable, that, you know, and out of respect, you never choose to pass it. You actually choose to stay in that space, in that stasis. And, you know, that's what happens at the end of Waiting for Godot, that, you know, there's a respectful holding back, not wanting to pass through to another space, you know.
Next musical choice is what, Jessie?
I love this William Onyebar song, and seeing as how we're speaking of the living and the dead and our connection, maybe heaven and hell.
Indeed, broadcasting to the living and the dead. This William Onyebar and heaven and hell from... This is something, this is really something. And that's William Onyebar and Heaven and Hell, the choice of Jessie Jones, who's with me in studio tonight picking the tracks. Jessie, Venice Biennale,
yeah.
Representing Ireland and all that. The last time we spoke in a public arena was before you went. It was before you went off.
In the studio.
Yeah. Well, how was it?
It was a totally amazing experience. It was really incredible.
It's hard to explain how big a deal the Venice Biennale is. I mean, it's a huge thing.
Yeah, I suppose artists know what a big deal it is. But I think I didn't even realise myself what a big deal it was. And actually, weirdly, I didn't realise how much it would be a kind of like moment of like nationality. So many Irish people went over, and
the president went, didn't he?
Yeah, Michael D came, and it was an incredible experience because Michael D came, and then he went to see the Pope, so it was like
he went to see you first.
Yeah,
quite right.
But you know, there's this kind of sense of what Venice is so ancient. When you're in Venice, you're just like, oh my God, humans are amazing. They built this, you know. It's like every time you walk out the door, it's just such a magical place. So to kind of get to stage any aesthetic idea that you have on that stage, that historic stage of
that
beauty.
Yeah, that never occurred to me. Of course, yeah.
Yeah, you have to do it in Venice, like Titian's only around the corner, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that. I mean, I'm aware it's a big deal and I know you're representing your country and all that, but yeah. You probably think you've got a bit of a nerve doing anything in that company, yeah.
But there's something about like the atmosphere of Venice, which just, I mean, the sound in Venice, the way music travels through the streets and bounces off the walls and comes back, and you know, the stones in Venice sing is the kind of famous phrase around Venice. But you know, to make an artwork that happens there, it also, you know, brings this whole other kind of like chorus to the artwork, because people are walking in from this place. And you know, the Irish Pavilion, we were in the Arsenale, which is, you know, 12th century old Arsenale. It's where they built the ships that wrecked Constantinople. You know, you're dealing with this vibration in that space. So you know, I was very lucky to make an artwork I really cared about and I really believed in.
So what did you do?
I made a film with Alwyn Furé, and it is a film installation with kind of an active element, which is this kind of curtain that moves. So it's a film, but it's also very spatial. So the story I developed with Alwyn was a way of thinking about female power, and it just kind of very randomly, sometimes you have a dream and the dream tells you what you need to do. A lot of the times I'll do a load of research and then, you know, I won't know what I'm doing at all. And I'll feel like, oh my God, I'm such a terrible artist. I've no ideas. I don't know how to distill this. And then you have a dream and you wake up and you're like, oh my God, there it is. That's the essential oil.
Well, here, tell me about that. An actual dream.
Yeah. So I had a dream. I was in Pendle in Lancashire, in a place where...
Hang on a minute. Yeah. Pendle?
Yeah.
The witches.
Do you know Pendle?
That's
exactly.
Where the witches are.
Yeah, I was at a kind of witches conference in Pendle.
We've left it a bit late to drop that bombshell. you're at a witches conference.
Yeah, it's on every year. It's really amazing. Sylvia Federici was there, who's a complete hero of mine. And I'd been doing all this research into the witch trials and having amazing conversations with Alwyn. And, something was distilling. It was kind of coming true, almost like you're kind of channeling, or you're trying to find a way through the mist and the haze of research to find out what this work is. And then I just went to sleep and I had a dream about Gulliver's Travels and woke up and said, it's got to be, Alwyn has to be a giant, you know, that's the way to create this visual spell of female power.
Back to the witches. The reason, I don't make many notes during these interviews, right? Mm. But I'm going to show you now as if by magic.
Okay.
The last word.
Did you draw a pentacle?
The last word on the page, witches. All right?
Oh, on your pre-printed thing.
I wrote witches.
Wow.
Because I just made a few notes. What I'll
That's
ask you about.
That's psychic,
John. No, I wrote New York, marching bands, Tala, Venice Biennale, witches. Now, the reason I wrote witches down was, again, the last time we spoke, you were talking about, you said that there was a time when women who did what you do as an artist, there was a time you would have been burned as a witch. Tell me more about that.
Well, I think I would have been a scold. You know, I would have had a bridle on me. I would have been definitely forced to shut up. And I think, you know, I say to my friend Eleanor, we're very lucky to live in Ireland right now, even though it's not perfect. You know, we still have so much to do and to fight to change. But I can't imagine living under Catholic Ireland. I can't imagine living in a time where I could have got sent to a laundry, you know, and I probably would have. I probably would have just been outside of that kind of conforming narrative that would have put my life in a very vulnerable place. And I suppose, you know, that's something that I don't take for granted. Mm. And I don't take that for granted as a woman. And I don't take for granted as an artist that for some fluke I've been offered a time to live in where, like, actually you can be a bolshy feminist and have a career in art. And that has not always been the case. And it might not always be the case. So,
that's the thing, isn't it? Because
yeah,
I think everybody's starting.
It's a precarious thing.
Yeah, people have started to realise. I've only started talking. I shouldn't be talking on behalf of people. I have only started to realise in the last couple of years that things don't move in the direction you think they're moving.
Like progress.
I thought progress was something that would keep moving forward. It never occurred to me, stupidly, it never occurred to me that things could go backwards.
Yeah.
And they're going backwards all over the world. Do you know what I mean? You kind of think,
absolutely.
Oh, Good Friday Agreement, oh, we move on. This happens, we move on. This happens, we move on. It never occurred to me that it could go back.
Yeah.
How dumb was I?
Yeah, but I mean, it's got to do with power, and power is something that oscillates, and who has power and, you know, who kind of controls the way we tell stories of that power. And I think there's moments when women had a lot more power than they do now. And things changed, and we had a very right-wing counter-revolution in this country, and we're only kind of waking up from that spell now, hopefully.
How does this tie in, and you just mentioned this in passing a moment ago, doing work in relation to witches and Pendleton? Are you tying all these things together in a work?
Yeah, well, when I made Tremble Tremble, but actually, to be honest, most of the way I've been thinking for the last couple of years has been about how to kind of describe, I guess, how power was taken from women. The witch trials very obviously are an explicit way of describing that. I've spoken about this before, but there's a brilliant book by Sylvia Federici, Caliban and the Witch. It's copyleft. If you Google it, you can read it. It's a PDF available online. And it is, I remember when I first read it, it was like the Matrix. It was like taking the pill in the Matrix, where you're like, oh my God, all of these systems of oppression that I've understood and have experienced, many of them, there's actually a reason and an architecture behind it that's got to do with ideology and capitalism. And, you know, some of the structures that we still have in place today are affected by, you know, the way we think about women's bodies in this country is, you know, that is a hangover from something that happened in the 16th century in relationship to capitalism. And obviously Ireland has a different timeline of experience with that, but it's definitely connected. So in a way, like finding out the ancestral solidarity of the witch as a vehicle of oppression, like how oppression was visited upon women in Europe at that time, creates a way to understand how we can form resistances to it again today. And actually, we need to be critical of the exact same thing that they were. You know, we need to be critical of ideological demagogues who go around and talk about women's bodies like it belongs to them or it's part of the public interest. It's not got to do with the public interest. It's an autonomous entity that can only be experienced by a woman herself, you know?
Next musical choice.
We should go Rhonda Dacher after that, right?
Okay, Rhonda Dacher and the Specials. Yeah. Rhonda Dacher, that's tough stuff. Yeah. Tough stuff, Jessie.
I've been thinking about this song for... It's a hard song to listen to, but it's also a very powerful song, to be honest, for me as a woman and for a lot of women. Rhonda Dacher wrote it for a friend of hers who had been raped. And, you know, it tells a very ordinary story about how something escalates very quickly into a violent rape. But I suppose, you know, in terms of like what every time you turn on the radio, listening to these very detailed stories, it's something that's really in our culture every day. And, you know, women very rarely get to speak from the position and the testimony of somebody who's experienced that. And it is rare that those voices get listened to. And I think that that's a very powerful song. It's a shame that it's not more well known, because actually as a song, it speaks to a type of experience and pain and rage and anger that not a lot of songs do.
OK, next musical choice.
PJ Harvey.
PJ Harvey. And which one do you want? Man-sized?
Man-sized. I think after coming through the Rhonda Dacher into, you know, it's almost like a rape revenge now. This is where we get revenge.
OK, PJ Harvey. I love Polly Harvey. She's wonderful, eh?
Yeah.
She's not just a singer, not just a performer, not just a songwriter. Everything about it, the whole act. She's got a whole thing going on. What she wears.
Yeah.
Everything. Performance art, kind of.
Yeah.
It?
And such a great role model. Like when PJ Harvey came out when I was a teenager, I was like, oh my God, there's somebody that you can look at as a woman and kind of see an example of how to be in the world. And you know, I think her music's incredible. I actually think I first heard about Sheila na Gigs through PJ Harvey. And it was like, what? There's Sheila na Gigs and there's PJ Harvey, you know? It's really amazing.
When there are people like, from your sort of end of the art world that seem to be sort of on the cutting edge and out there and avant-garde, whatever these words you want to use, or other people use. I'm not saying you want to use it, but other people use. And they have a huge influence on popular culture, feeds back the other way.
Mm.
You know, you get Marina Abramovic, and then you look at Lady Gaga and you go, well, I know where you got that.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You can
well, she
see
probably
that.
Got more of that from Carly Schneeman than Marina Abramovic.
You worked with her, didn't you?
Well, I knew her in New York.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing artist.
Jessie, what's in the plans? What are you at?
I'm developing the show for Project. So Tremble Tremble is coming home.
This is the witch thing, yeah?
Yeah, this is the project with Alwyn Furay, and it's going to open in Project Arts Centre on the 7th of June. So that's kind of, you know, it's that kind of thing of like, it's the hometown show. And, you know, it went great in Venice, and people who've seen it in Venice, you know, really enjoyed it. But bringing it home to Dublin is really important to me, and having that like audience for it in Ireland is really important to me.
Well, Jesse, thanks a million for coming in. Thanks for picking all these tunes tonight. It's great. It was a real trip.
It's a pleasure, John.
It just starts with Elvis Presley. It's a very good start.
Yeah.
Your last choice, Jesse, Damien Dempsey. You were always on my mind. Jesse Presley Jones. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.